You're listening to a program produced in 2017 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. War Draft. And the First Resistance chapter was founded in Palo Alto tonight. You'll hear more about it by David Harris himself, a former Stanford University student body president in 1967. And the Los Angeles Resistance was founded here in Westwood in 67 by Donald Don Kalish, the former chair of UCLA Philosophy. And it was part of a national network of local resistance chapters which coordinated the efforts nationwide to stop the draft. The archives of the Los Angeles Draft Resistance are now part of the collection of the Los Angeles Public Library. They're being digitized, which is really exciting. It's a real impetus to do the event tonight. They're being digitized and uploaded to the LAPL website as we speak, so they'll be accessible to all. And it's a very precious collection of activist history, and the Los Angeles Public Library is very honored to be the guardians of it. I want to thank the librarians and special collections, especially Ani, are you here somewhere, Ani Sanjin, for your great work in taking care of this collection. Thank you so much. I found my way to volunteer with the LA Draft Resistance when I was in high school here in Los Angeles, and I felt the gravitational pull towards a community working together against an unjust war to which young Americans were being sent to fight and die. But what catalyzed that pull for me was in the summer of 1967 on the campus of Stanford University Program for High School Students when I heard David Harris, then Stanford student body president, give an electrifying speech. And you're going to get to hear David tonight along with three other extraordinary activists. Our moderator tonight, and here from New York City, is Clara Bingham, author of several books and a former Newsweek White House correspondent whose work has been published in many periodicals. Her most recent book is Witness to the Revolution, Radicals, Resistors, Vets, Hippies, and the Year America Lost Its Mind and Found Its Soul. It's a brilliant oral history with a great title of the events of 1969 and 70, and it has been lauded as great reportage from the front lines of history. And Clara will be signing that book in the lobby for us tonight after the program, courtesy of our library store. Our three other panelists and resistance veterans are Winter Karen Dellenbach, who was a founder and organizer of the Los Angeles Resistance. Winter was a public interest law attorney and remains an advocate for low-income people and a political activist, and she's here from Palo Alto. Bob Zhao left UCLA grad school, turned in his draft cards, refused to take a physical, and refused induction, and defended himself in federal court. He headed up Peace Press for 20 years and has been involved in issues such as opposing Diablo Canyon and nuclear testing, and recently was a key person in the reentry work for amnesty case Gary Tyler, who's our guest here tonight. Gary, where are you? Somewhere in the audience. Who was in Angola, imprisoned for a crime he did not commit. And we're very happy to have you here with us tonight, Gary. Thank you. And David Harris, who in 1966, then Stanford's radical student body president, announced he would no longer cooperate with a selective service system and urged everyone else to do the same. He then helped found the resistance and organize civil disobedience against the draft in the West and nationally for the next 3 years. He was incarcerated between 1969 and 1971, mostly in the Federal Correction Institution in Latuna, Texas. Since his release, he's pursued a 40-year career as a journalist and a writer and is the author of 11 books. Before we begin tonight, and we will take your questions after the panel discussion, and we hope that you'll make those questions. I know you have your own experiences to share, but we'll try and get to as many of you as we can. There's a documentary film in progress about the draft resistance movement called The Boys Who Said No. And at a fundraiser for that over the weekend, David Harris noted of himself and other resistors, quote, "At the time we were doing and we figured that the history would take care of itself and we would just proceed with what we were up to and let the rest be sorted out in the aftermath. Well, so much for that. The history is being lost. And the reason we're here today is to save that history. Save it because it's extraordinary history, not just in the lives of those who resisted at the time, but in the history of our country. And that's also why we're here tonight, because we need to know this Vietnam War draft. And the First Resistance chapter was founded in Palo Alto tonight. You'll hear more about it by David Harris himself, a former Stanford University student body president in 1960.
Hi, thank you all for coming. I'm Clara. I'm going to moderate, and I'm very excited to be on the stage with people who I consider my personal heroes, and I'm excited to get them to tell us their stories here in one room all together. And little did we know how relevant their stories are today when this panel was planned months ago. So we have lots to discuss. I just wanted to open briefly with how important the draft was in America, because 27 million young men were of draft age between 1967 and 1973. So it politicized a generation. And it was eventually called the Great Refusal, what my friends here were part of. 2.2 million young men were drafted, and over 500,000 violated draft laws. 25,000 were indicted, 9,000 convicted, and 3,250 draft resistors were jailed. So it gives you a sense of the volume of the resistance. And of those who were actually in the armed services, 400,000 of them deserted. So I thought we could start with David, who can tell us his story of why he started the resistance and what motivated him to put his life on the line.
Well, first, I have the housekeeping details of reminding people what the selective service system was. Most of you look like you may very well have carried a draft card back there, but there's probably some people who aren't on Medicare who are here. The Selective Service Act of 1947 was America's first peacetime conscription. Under its requirements, all males were required to register with the government when they turned 18. You went down to the post office, signed a paper, and there you were. And you were required, once you had registered, you were required to carry proof of your registration on your person at all times. This was the notorious draft card. The system granted various kinds of deferments to those people who registered. You wouldn't be drafted if you were a student in university making reasonable progress towards a degree. There were other physical exemptions, and there was the most famous classification, which was 1A, which meant you were on the list and you were headed for Southeast Asia. The penalties involved with this law were refusal to obey the order to report for induction into the United States Army was a 5-year felony. Advocating that anyone refuse to carry out the orders was another 5 years for each advocacy. So that's the context that all this takes place in. My generation of young men walked around carrying this card, which became an enormous symbol, and what we did was go out and assault that symbol. I registered when I turned 18 during my freshman year at Stanford, and nothing was the same after that. I had come to Stanford as the Fresno High School Boy of the Year, and I didn't win any more titles like that. In 1964, I went to Mississippi as a civil rights worker and the attempt to get black people the right to vote in the state of Mississippi. And that was the great life-changing event for my generation. Once you'd seen Mississippi, you couldn't go back the same way. And almost as soon as I was back from Mississippi, here came the Vietnam War. And when you talk about motivation for all of us, it starts at the war. And looking back on it now, we can see really clearly. And looking out at it then, we saw it really clearly. This was a war that killed more than 2 million people for no good reason. And that was a war that demanded response. your very humanity was at stake. If you ignore that, then what kind of human being are you? And who's going to hold those deaths accountable? Somebody has to answer for those. And we wanted to force that question. And my forcing of the question began in 1966, right after I was elected Stanford student body president in one of the great accidents of history that nobody has been able to explain. At that point, I returned my student deferment, saying I didn't think that, as much as I disagreed with the war, I didn't think it should be fought by just poor people. That those people without the wherewithal to go to college ought to have the same break as everybody else. And I wasn't going to be part of taking that special privilege. Then I followed that by finally deciding that I was through with it altogether. I put my draft cards in a envelope and sent it to my local draft board and told them I was done and that they knew where they could find me and I wasn't going anywhere. But in the meantime, I was going to do everything I could to make sure there were as many people doing the same thing I was doing as I could, which I then proceeded to do. In the spring of 1967, we founded an organization called the Resistance, and we set out organizing the first national draft card return, where in the fall of 1967, some 3,000 young men from around the country at various locations, I think we're 18 different cities, returned their draft cards to the government. We didn't burn them. We didn't try to hide. Our message was very simple. Here we are. We're not going anywhere. If you're going to prosecute this war, then you're going to have to prosecute us in order to do that. And I spent the next 3 years of my life going back and forth and around in every place I could. I must have given about 1,000 speeches during that period of time, looking for people who would commit civil disobedience against the Selective Service Act. I was ordered up during that period. I was ordered for induction and refused. I was indicted and tried in the city of San Francisco and sentenced to 3 years in prison. I stayed out on appeal for a year, and then I went into prison. I served a month in San Francisco County Jail, 7 months in a prison camp in Arizona, and 12 months in a federal correctional institution in West Texas in a maximum security cell block. And then, despite having the worst disciplinary report in the entire institution, I was paroled. Looking back on it, I'm really glad I did that. You know, at the time, I said I wanted to get to be 70 years old and be able to look back at this period of time and feel good about it. Well, I'm 70, and it feels really good. We did the right thing. More importantly, I think we were a prime factor in helping save what little was left of the American soul from that enterprise. That we called the moral question that had to be called. And if we lose track of that moral question, I think we are done for as a country. And I'm still looking for that accounting for the people who did that. I think we should all keep looking for it. And when we find it, we'll be a much better country.
Thank you, David. Winter, tell us how you got involved in the resistance and why.
I got involved in the resistance because the chairman of the philosophy department at UCLA came to me after he knew that I had sat in at the placement center at UCLA where I was a student, that a call went out for students to come to the placement center because Dow Chemical, the maker of napalm in Vietnam, was recruiting on campus. And I thought to myself, am I becoming serious about my feelings about this war? I was a very straight kid, grew up in a very provincial town, an orange-growing town in Southern California, And I had started to really think about this war. And I thought, I think I am getting serious. And if I'm getting serious, I need to start acting out and being committed, showing my commitment. So I went up to the center, and I sat down. There were about 12 guys there and myself. And I sat down, and in fact, we shut the center down for the day. And a dean of students came in at one point and talked to us. And he said, listen, you're in danger of being suspended, and you're going to get kicked out of school maybe, and I'm going to tell your parents. And all the dozen guys got up and walked out. And I'm just sitting there, and I'm going, what just happened? What happened to the commitment? And I had another talk with myself, and I just stayed there. And I thought, I have to be committed. And so I stayed, and the place was shut down for the rest of the day. And then the dean came back and said, well, okay, now it's the end of the day, and we're going home, and you did it, so would you just go home too? And I said, okay, and I left. And because of that, the chair of the philosophy department, I think, saw something in me that maybe I could be good to carry through a task, and he said, I'm opening a draft resistance office in Westwood Village, the town attached to near UCLA, and I need somebody to staff that office. And would you be willing to do that? Well, summer was coming up, and I thought about it, and I said, you know, I'd like to do that. That, you know, kind of fits the trajectory that my life and my thinking seems to be going on. I think I could do that. This coincided. The reason that he was doing this is because Dr. Martin Luther King had declared, much of David went down south during Freedom Summer in 64. Dr. King had pronounced that the summer of 67 would be Vietnam summer, and that this summer would be dedicated to trying to stop the war in Vietnam, organizing around the war in Vietnam. And so summer 67, Vietnam summer, was when the draft resistance office was opened in Westwood Village near UCLA, and I was the first staff person. And I wasn't the first staff person for very long, though, because it was really an idea whose time has come. And it took a very short amount of time before I went over to campus and I saw this guy in a cowboy hat and shades talking, of course. Kind of, he never stopped talking. And the guy he was traveling around with at the time talking about the resistance and draft resistance. I'm going, hey, well, that's what we're doing. And just like that, I mean, you know, we didn't have to have a meeting or anything, because it was kind of me and maybe one or two other people. We became the resistance, the LA resistance, the Los Angeles resistance. And very quickly, I got to know David, and David started to speak around Los Angeles, and Bob Zaw walked in the door, and a whole lot of resistors in Chernigluck and people that are in this audience tonight started to gravitate to our office. And we just took off. People got to work very, very hard, and with the idea moving toward October 16th, which was the first national draft card turn-in, and a week called Stop the Draft Week in the United States. October 16th, 1967, the 50th anniversary is coming up this year in October. And that really galvanized the resistance movement all over the United States, was shooting for that October 16th. And one of the things that was notable about LA resistance was that women were involved. Why would women be involved in draft resistance? We couldn't be drafted. No. But as David said, we were in jeopardy too if we advocated for others to resist the draft. And in fact, not just women, but men that were a little bit beyond draft age, over the age of 26, they also became involved. And we had a whole lot of supporters. The supporters were organized. Clergy became strong supporters. Many women became involved. And we had a very strong organization. We made alliances with other groups in the community. We tried to reach out as best we could into other groups, black groups and groups that were more difficult to get alliances with at that point. It was really a tremendous opportunity both for personal growth for the people that got involved, but also became a real catalyst, I think, for a lot of other organizations, because they worked within their own organizations, but people within those organizations became resistors. And I'm very proud of the work we did with Los Angeles Resistance and with the resistors, many of whom refused inductions, many of whom ended up in prison, and many of whom went on trial and one way or another didn't go to prison. And every day I spent with LA Resistance made me a better person. I'm 71 years old, and every lesson I learned from that has helped me along the way and brought me to the point that I'm at now, where I feel like I'm getting ready to take these next steps that we're all being confronted with. And I feel I'm ready.
Thank you, Winter. Bob, tell us your story.
Well, I'm kind of Joe Ordinary. I'm not a leader or anything like that, but I wanted to have something to do with social change. And I went to college kind of to avoid the war. I could get a 2S. And, you know, I hung out in Watts after the riots, and they said, if you want to do something, go to your own community. We'll handle this. You go do something about that war. And I went back to UCLA, and I heard David Harris. And you heard some of the words in that film clip. It was very potent stuff about withdrawing your participation. Now, most people are trapped in an envelope of their own fears, fears put on by the government and our habits, and we seldom step outside of that envelope. And you have to do that if you're going to have social change. So I started off my political activism by turning in my 2S very tentatively. And they sent me a 1A, and then I publicly turned in my draft card at the second draft card resistance day. It was December 4th. And it's a public act, and it's a felony. Anything you did was a felony. There were petitions in the paper with hundreds or thousands of signatures. That's not only a felony, it's a conspiracy. And so I signed things like that. I started working with the resistance. I set up speeches for David Harris. I went onto college campuses, and I would look for a teacher, a student with long hair, and ask them where the liberal teachers were. Then I would track down the teachers, and I would ask if we could speak in their class. Actually, I wanted other people to speak in their class. I was terrified of speaking. And little did I realize that they were taking their own academic freedom in hand and loaning it to us to let us speak in their class. It really put their careers in danger, but many of them did it. Finally, I took a physical and I flunked it because I had rheumatoid spondylitis, and I got a 1Y, and that's one of these deferments David was talking about, where in the case of 1Y, they want to keep the draft, keep you running around in the maze. Back, say, the Korean War times, earlier times, if you took a physical and flunked it, you had a 4F, and you were done with it. They gave you 1Y, they could test you every year, and it kept you running around in the maze. So I turned in that 1Y. That's another felony. Then they called me for another physical. This time I refused to take it. So I've gradually gotten the courage up to actually stop my participation in the war. They declare me a 1A. I turn it in. They declare me 1A delinquent. I turn that in. Then they indict me, and I go into court with two felonies, refusing to take a physical and refusing induction. That's two potential five-year sentences. In L.A., the agreement was to sentence you to 3 years if you were convicted of refusing induction. So one of the first points I made to the judge in defending myself was a point we still need to make. As recently as 2 days ago at the fundraising event, we were mentioned as draft dodgers, and we're not draft dodgers. And I still have to make this point. We weren't dodging the draft. We went right out and faced it. So I pointed out to the judge that I was not even qualified for the draft because I had rheumatoid spondylitis. So please hear me out. And he did hear me out. And when I was done, he convicted me of refusing to take a physical, but he acquitted me of refusing induction. I don't know why. And then he sentenced me to work in the national interest, and I refused. I said, I'm working at Peace Press. We print for the Communist Party, Daniel Ellsberg, the Black Panthers, Socialist Party, ACLU. That's life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and that's what I'm doing. And he never did anything about it. I thought it was my brilliant defense that had won the day, but I talked to my judge 3 months ago. He's 93 years old. His name is Harry Pragerson. He's the best judge in America. And I spent 3 hours with him. Gary Tyler and I spent 3 hours with him. And he told me that after he visited one of us in prison at Lompoc, he decided he wasn't going to send anybody else to prison for the draft. And I was his next case. So I was just fortunate. But another point that David may make later, but he mentioned this years ago, is that we each have a constituency. And that's still a principle he talks about. And it's one of the main principles I took away from that day, and I still speak about it. And his point was that people are watching you, and they may do what you do. And so I've always paid attention to that in trying to keep integrity in my own life in case somebody wants to do what I've been doing. And what I've seen as a result of that is that I have personally driven 5 people to Mercury, Nevada test site to get arrested, that I've personally been involved with somehow getting people to the point where they choose to commit civil disobedience, and that changes their life. And then they're going to spread that on. It's a point that David made close to 50 years ago, and it's true. And I've followed that point ever since. And I'm hoping that where we're at right now with Standing Rock, I think that people are going to have to consider stepping out of their little envelope and step by step moving towards more action, potential civil disobedience. If we're just doing Facebook, then somebody in the NSA office back east is going to say, they're still on Facebook. They haven't got up and left their desk yet, so we're fine. We've got Facebook has its point. It's done a lot of good work, but we're going to have to move beyond that.
Thanks, Bob. I want to get to what to do now in a little bit. I definitely want to finish up with what to do now and lessons learned, and so we'll want to get to that. David, I wanted to ask you if you could tell us a little bit about your prison life and also those of some of your colleagues and what you all did, and why did you end up in maximum security?
Well, I wasn't a very good prisoner from the guards' point of view. We were a community in prison, and draft resistors had a good reputation with other convicts. Because we stood up for convicts, and so we went in organizing. And I was in my first strike in San Francisco County Jail about 2 weeks after I was arrested, and I was in 2 more strikes at prison camp in Safford, Arizona.
What were you striking about? Was there a particular issue, or was it just because you were there you were striking?
The issues in prison are real simple. You know, food, health care, visits. Those are convict issues. And the first strike I was in at Safford was over the food because we could see guards pulling up to the chow hall, taking out sides of beef, putting them in their pickup trucks and taking them home, and they were giving us hamburgers that were mostly bread filler. So we asked for better food in our own fashion. And then the next strike was for medical care. They had taken an illegal immigrant prisoner and who who had an epileptic fit, and they strapped him to a gurney and left him there. And when news of that got around, we went on strike. And after my third strike, I was out. So they put me in a car and drove me to Texas and threw me in the disciplinary cell block for a couple months and then moved me up to maximum security. So, you know, the thing you learn in prison, which is true everywhere you go, is that, you know, they got your body. There's nothing you can do about that. They got your body. But they can't get your mind unless you give it to them. And that's what you do as a prisoner, is how you hold on to your mind. And that's what we were doing with the strikes. That's what we did with our individual behavior. Part of that was just refusing to be intimidated. I mean, they would come to my cell and threaten me and say, you know, if you don't straighten up, we're going to send you to Leavenworth. And I'd say, okay, I've heard about Leavenworth. That sounds like a great place. I'd like to see it before I'm done here. Pack my shit. I'm ready to go. And of course, they weren't going to send me to Leavenworth because of their own bureaucratic issues. But anyway, that's what we were doing in prison with our spare time.
Amazing. Winter, we all know that the FBI and the Nixon administration had an undercover war against the anti-war movement. And I was wondering if you could share with us some of the experience you had as a victim of that to some extent.
Well, I won't call myself a victim in that it was a blanket program, COINTELPRO, counterintelligence program. It was completely illegal. The church hearings in 1972, there were hearings about it. It was stopped, and the uncovering was a burglary in Medio, Pennsylvania by some resistors and peace people when they burglarized a small FBI office and got a hold of files that revealed that this illegal surveillance of peace movement people was taking place under J. Edgar Hoover. And the COINTELPRO program was so widespread that if any of you folks, I'm sure there are many people in the audience that have FBI files. It was a notorious program. The net was spread very, very wide, and it certainly ensnared the resistance, not only Los Angeles resistance, but any resistance office, any peace office. It was brutal with the Black Panthers. They murdered the Panthers with their surveillance and their murderous ways. And it came in. It affected resistance and myself and people I know just by the constant surveillance and following us after resistance events. I mean, literally following us and cars, undercover agents. We always knew FBI agents were around when we had demonstrations because back then, in those days, in the late 60s, J. Edgar Hoover, he was such a creep. Oh, and he had very strict rules. He had a dress code for the agents, so all of the agents had to wear black suits and they had to be very properly dressed. And well, you know how we were all dressed back then. I mean, people were casual, if not more so. And long hair and jeans and love beads and whatever. And here were these guys in suits at our demonstrations and dark suits. And they had these curly Q things coming down from their ears. And they always had shades on. And okay, there's your FBI agent and there's one there and there's one there. And they were always around. And so sometimes it was a little bit amusing, but actually in the long run, it really wasn't amusing, and we tried to do things. We were careful about what we said on the phone because there were illegal wiretaps, there were opening mail, they were doing all kinds of things. We weren't quite certain what all they were doing, but we knew vaguely it was all happening. We had our first resistance office in the first one in Westwood Village, and the records that I have through the Freedom of Information Act certainly has confirmed what we suspected, which is the FBI went to the landlord and pressured the landlord to evict us, which happened. And so we had to get a new office in a different on Westwood Boulevard. So we did that, but that they went after peace groups that way of harassment and intimidation. They phonied up evidence in an arrest and arrested me and some other resistance people at one point with what could have been some very dire consequences, which we managed to get out of. But they didn't mess around. This was law-breaking, Bill of Rights, First Amendment. This was very, very serious stuff.
How many pages is your FBI file?
8,000. That's myself and the resistance, and that's just what they have found so far. That took an appeal. The first time they found 800 pages, and I appealed, and they said, "Oh, we found 7,000 more that we overlooked the first time." So I don't really know how much is there, but it certainly makes for interesting reading. But What's extraordinary is the amount of resources expended, the both taxpayer money and the extraordinary resources. And when you think where this could be directed, because we're just one organization and our group of people, but you multiply that all over the country just a zillion times over, and you just think of the wholesale waste and the mispriorities and the betrayal. The absolute betrayal of democracy. It is just stunning and disgusting. So yes, we were not unusual in that kind of surveillance, but that doesn't make it any less serious.
Well, amazing too that you all were a nonviolent group and that they still therefore merited that much surveillance. I wanted to ask the three of you about what you think the impact was of the resistance on the movement in general and also on the administration's conduct in the war.
You wanted to start, Bob?
You know, one of the things I did was go down to the federal building every week and pick up the indictments for this district, and that's indictments for all federal crimes. And I did it every week. And one of the things I was looking for was somebody's name from the resistance to see if they'd been indicted, like Jeff Fishman here tonight. I had his indictment list in the back of my car. But the point is that about 30% of the indictments being handed down in this district were for Selective Service violations. I heard the percentage in the Bay Area of people avoiding the draft was like 50%. So the government wanted to keep that. They didn't want people to really know about that because we were effective in passing the word, and they didn't like that. And it's a tactic, you know, when going to jail in Mercury, Nevada for the Nevada test site, basically they can't prosecute you anymore because there's so many people that were doing it. They just had to stop, and that's actually a tactic that the movement considers is let's stop this machine, just as David said, pulling our participation.
I mean, we weren't big enough to stop the machine as much as we'd have liked. I mean, we'd have liked it that they, you know, that they called their war and nobody came. I mean, that was our goal, and we never got to that point. But by 1971, they were having to draft three people to get one into the Army on a national basis. So we had discredited military conscription. We also called the question, if you will, on the peace movement and said, look, it's not just enough to have an opinion. As long as you continue to cooperate with the war effort, which is when you carry a draft card, which is exactly what you're doing, then it doesn't matter what you think about the war. The war goes on. It's withdrawing your participation that really makes the difference. And I think brought a lot of people out of the woodwork who weren't there before. And finally, you know, the great measure of effectiveness was essentially how your parents responded, at least figuratively. Those were the people that we were trying to reach with the message about the war. And the willingness of us to take the kind of risks that we were taking and make the kind of sacrifice that we were making with the attitude we brought with it was enough to touch those people's hearts. What happened, the reason the war stopped was because America changed its mind about the war. And I think our willingness to say, look, this is as serious as it gets, I think was a key factor in that tidal wave that eventually swept the war out. And, you know, people watch and listen and change. And we as a movement always tried to keep the door open to that, to the possibility of people changing. We didn't call people pigs. We didn't fight with the police. We said, join us. And we always left the door open for people to join us. We didn't draw lines in the sand and say, you're with us or you're against us. We said, join us.
And if I could add, it had a ripple effect. I mean, you mentioned family. You mentioned people, inviting people, inclusiveness, inviting people to join us. But it had a ripple effect in very odd corridors. It had ripple effect. Bob mentioned his judge. It became in Los Angeles, more and more federal judges refused to hear resister cases. They had just had it. They did not want to try resisters because they sympathized with resisters. So there were judges that would hear resisters cases, but there were a whole lot of federal judges that refused anymore. So the judges were refusing. The judges weren't cooperating. There were U.S. attorneys. That's no small thing to be a U.S. attorney. That is a very elite level to be a U.S. attorney, who were starting to not want to take on resistance cases. Or they would have resistance cases and they would find their own avenues in order to try to figure out how to help the resistor. One refused to make any objections during the resistor's trial. They just sat there quietly, no matter what the resistor who was representing themselves said. They just wouldn't make an objection. A U.S. attorney took a draft file for a resistor who is probably going to be retried and stuck it in his desk instead of returning it to the Selective Service so that it would just stay there till the person was 26 years old and out of jeopardy. Things started to unravel. And just as David said, it wasn't as if everything came to a stop. Is it not that they gave a war and no one came? But you don't need to get to that place. You need to get to the place where there has been enough unraveling, where those connections, those synapses, things don't hold together anymore, where the system isn't functioning. Too many people are just going off the ranch. And it was quite extraordinary. When a resistor would act, what are you going to say to them? It was an extraordinary thing to do, to simply say, no, I'm not going to do it, and I'm going to tell you about it, and I'm not going to hide. And it would grab people, and it would make them ashamed if they would try to deny what the person was doing. So it was extremely effective beyond the numbers of people that resisted.
Bob, can you tell us what you think the impact was of the movement?
Well, I agree with what they said, and I think the culture changed. You know, people became active in things other than the resistance. We got the ecology movement, all the things of the 70s, I think, came from the resistance type activities we did. And that point about constituency, I saw it true in my own life, and I'm assuming that people watched people in the resistance for many years, and they've perhaps taken on some of those actions themselves. So I'm hopeful about the future, and I'm pleased with what I did in the past. I plan to continue in the future. I hope people can maybe find something in what we said or did that could be applied to what's going on around us. There's going to be plenty of opportunities to choose an action, and we need to, it has to be an action. It can't be just signing a petition or tweeting. You got to do more than tweet.
Well, that brings us to hashtag resistance, which is the new mass, nearly mass movement that we're looking at that's dawning in the age of Trump. And I wanted to ask our panelists for lessons learned. What were the mistakes that were made in the late 60s, and what were the successes, and how can those lessons be applied to today? And actually, my first specific one was at Berkeley, that protest last week got violent, as we know, and so did some of the protests during the inaugural parade, probably conducted by the same group of anarchists. But they reminded me, I couldn't help but, they reminded me of the Weather Underground, who by 1969 had left SDS and became more militant and violent and started a long bombing campaign. And I am wondering if you saw that parallel and if you might be able to draw some conclusions about that, David, in particular.
Well, they're both sets of idiots. What, blowing up urinals in the Capitol building? That doesn't count as political action. Well, hey.
We can look at the impact. Well, but there was a big backlash that occurred because
Go with that. They're brave and principled people. But they also discredited the movement. That was the...
Well,
so what?
Well, I think we can wait for questions later, and this is clearly a very controversial issue. But I do think that it's important now to look at what happened then, and I'd like to hear from David and our panelists of what they think is the most important thing for the movement to do now.
But the most important thing is that we have to go to those people who are on the other side and make inroads there. You know, it's not enough just to square off with all of our friends. We need to go into those red states and be able to change the political dynamic there and address directly the issue of what kind of country do we want to be. And not simply talk to our friends. I mean, politics is talking to strangers, and we need to do that. And it's not just enough to make it, do you like Donald Trump or not? We have to find a way to speak with those people and find common cause. And if we can do that, then I think we can retrieve the situation. If we can't, and I think going to demonstrations and breaking windows, which is what's been going on certainly in the Bay Area, every time you have a demonstration, a group shows up that wants to go break windows. And you do that, you don't win over people breaking windows. It just simply doesn't happen. And I think that urge to say you're with us or against us and draw that line in the sand is a great mistake for a movement. I think the movement died when we started doing that in the 60s. And you're absolutely right. I shouldn't have been so dismissive and appreciated where people are coming from. But I think they were sadly mistaken. I think the effect was to discredit the movement when you start blowing up people and things. And we're not going to be able to talk to the people we need to talk to if that's the face we present them with. And the simple fact is if we don't talk to those people, then we're goners. We're going to be in exactly the same situation we're stuck in right now.
Do you think there was a tactic that you all used, a strategy you all used to reach out to people who were maybe on the fence about the war, who weren't necessarily obvious anti-war types?
By treating them like human beings and approaching them that way. I mean, it's not rocket science. It's that question of walking in somebody else's shoes. If you assume their humanity, then you have something to talk to. If you assume their inhumanity, then you're just stuck in the situation and you fight. And fights aren't going to get us out. It's just not the way it's going to happen. And I think everybody comes out of a fight more self-righteous than they went into it, usually. And self-righteousness is our enemy, and certainly the enemy of the people who are on the opposite side from us. And we got to find a way to break down the sides. And I think that's particularly true because if we talk about what the real problems are that are sitting out in our future, they require us to be more than a 50-50 split. There's no way that climate change is ever going to be addressed by a 50-50 split. We need to make a 75-25 split in order to deal with climate change because of the changes it's going to demand from us. And so we got to get about the business of making that transition. And that means reaching out. And, you reach out with a closed fist, it gets the response that you know is going to happen. So, and I think acting that way and carrying those values into the situation gives us an opportunity. And it's just that, it's an opportunity.
Winter, you all sustained this particular resistance movement for over 3 years, up to maybe even 4, you would call it. And the women were the ones who weren't in jail, so you were still manning the barricades. But how would you advise today's activists to have that sort of stamina and to, not to burn out?
Well, I mean, actually, that was exactly what I was going to talk about, because I think that when I look at what's happening now, I feel I can make some predictions that, and I can see what some things that happened back then that feel a little bit lessons learned, which is this. Right now, things are pretty heady in a way. I mean, things are scary, at least for me, a little bit scary, certainly much unknown as to what is going to happen, but also very exciting there to see so many people so quickly because of social media. It's so much easier communication now than back then. Instead of having to crank out leaflets and then go physically pass them out and get up early in the morning and go to the induction center and all of that laborious stuff, and now it's so fast. I mean, it is miraculous, and you can put a response together quickly. It is terrific. But you can only have big marches are terrific, and I went on them. And I will go on more, and I hope everybody will go on more. And they are vital, and they are terrific, and they're positive, and we must do them. However, there will come a time when big marches will become less newsworthy because we've done them, and we've done them, and we've done them. So one size will not fit all. It is going to take a lot more. There will need to be specific responses to specific things. There will need to, people, we will need to specialize. People will need to pick and choose possibly one thing or two things that really captures your interest that you will need to, I will need to make a long-term commitment to, because you know what? This is going to entail a long-term commitment. In fact, it's always been a long-term commitment. It's just it feels more in crisis right now because actually it is seems to me a crisis right now. But get ready for a long slog and make a big, big commitment and be there for a long time. So that means trying to pace yourself, trying to, so that you don't get burned out, making allegiances, Bob's kind of alluded to it, with maybe a core group of people where you can support each other, have some fun with each other, make some friends, and really commit to some projects. Because back in the 60s and the 70s, there were periodically really big marches, but you know what? Those marches were also ignored. Those big marches did not stop the war, just as Brother David was saying. They did not in and of themselves stop it. These marches now are not going to stop what's going on. They will not stop it. They will help, but they will not stop it.
And so we
must do more.
Remember that if there was one rule we learned out of the 60s, is, or at least that I felt I learned, was you get what you do. You don't get what you talk about. You get what you do. And whatever your reasons, whatever your rhetoric, if you do things that damage, you're left with damage. You know, it's the, you know, the famous quote from the Vietnam War was a captain who, after having destroyed a Vietnamese village, pronounced that he had destroyed the village in order to save it. No, you destroy the village, that's it. That's what you did, that's what you're stuck with. And that's true for us, it's true for anybody. You don't, you know, it doesn't, it's an iron law. And so we have to pay attention to our own behavior in this process and make sure that it exemplifies the values that we want to see. Because that's whatever the values are that are in our behavior is what we're going to be left with at the end of it. And I think that's easy to forget in the heat of the moment, but I think it's an important lesson. It's the most important one I've learned during that entire period, and I spent 10 years as an organizer doing that.
I have one last question, and then we're going to open it up to the audience for questions, which is one of the victories of the anti-war movement, particularly the resistance movement, was the end of the draft. In 1973, Nixon ended the draft. We haven't seen it since. And I'm curious to know whether you three think in the long term now that, you know, we're almost 50 years out, if you think that really was a victory or not, the end of the draft?
Absolutely, it was a victory. And, you know, there's a lot of talk in the current moment about people saying, well, gee, you know, you had the advantage of the draft back then because that politicized everybody and made organizing easier. And so if what we really need is a new draft. And I don't subscribe to that theory. In fact, what the draft did was enable the government to wage war in Southeast Asia in ways it never would have otherwise. Can you imagine what George W. Bush would have done with a draft army? And he looked like a saint if compared to this guy we got now. I mean, it's a blank check. And I think it's, you know, it's being passed as, well, this is going to be national service, and we'll let people do all kinds of different activities. And I'm a great believer in service. I feel like I've spent a lot of my life in service. But service is not done under the threat of prosecution. That's not service. That's servitude. And I say make service available to everybody for options. I mean, the government can develop all kinds of programs that let people go out and serve in communities that need service. I think that's a great idea. But when you start arresting people if they don't do it, that becomes a whole nother proposition. And, you know, our forefathers fled Europe to get away from conscription, and there's a reason they did. And there's a reason that it was considered freedom to be in a country that didn't have conscription. And I don't buy it.
Yeah. Do either of you differ?
I do not differ, but I want to have my say, which is that I in no way want this government under any administration to have control over millions of lives to say you all have to go do that over here or over here. You have to make war, or we can take, you know, some sort of mandatory civilian service, and we can change it into now we're going to also have you do war. And remember that back then it was men. Well, this time it's going to be women too, so it's going to be bigger. And there's no way I'm going to give the government that kind of control. And also remember that, no, we don't have a universal draft, but we have a poverty draft. I mean, it's not exactly the same as a draft, but we do have a poverty draft because of the miserable income equality we have in this country. Talk about a betrayal and broken promises and how we shabby way we're treating our citizens in this country. And that's the last thing in the world I want is a draft. If the only way that human beings can get themselves together to cooperate, to organize and activate a response to evil and to bad things happening is when they're under the gun, I think that's unfortunate. We have got to be able to organize and respond just because it is needed and not because we have something like the draft hanging over our heads. We have to learn to be better than that. You know, I want to say one last thing. I was lucky enough to know Carl Sagan, the cosmologist. I knew him. I was lucky enough to be able to fix a wonderful Indian dinner for him on the flat roof of a treehouse that I lived in two years.
Where
and
was that? Just that
was in the foothills, the Palo Alto foothills, with my then partner. We fixed a nice Indian dinner for him, and something that Carl said that has always stuck with me. He said, "In those billions and billions of intelligent civilizations out there in the cosmos, every one of them will confront or has confronted this. Every intelligent civilization has had to go through a period of adolescence. And if it doesn't make it through adolescence, it will become extinct. And that intelligent species will die out. And then others will make it through their adolescent period, and it will go on, and it will probably prosper, and it will probably survive." And that has always stuck with me, and I think right now we have the ultimate adolescent in the White House. And I wonder, and it is our time to see if we will, you know, move beyond this, and that's just kind of where we are in our species evolution, I feel. It's one way to kind of hold it in my mind. But I don't want this government or any other to have the power of the draft to weld against anyone else on this planet or me.
Let's go to questions.
Thank you. Time for questions. Anyone? I think we have a microphone's coming around.
Question?
Right there.
Hi. Can you tell me, in general, what the feeling in the resistance was towards deferments? And I've always thought that in part the Vietnam War was ended when they got rid of student deferments. And I'd like your comments on that.
Well, I think that my feelings about the student deferment were what I said. I thought essentially it ensured that blacks died at twice the rate of whites. Spanish speakers died at three times the rate of Anglos in that conflict. And it was because they weren't—they didn't have the economic wherewithal to go to college. And I thought that was a kind of disproportionate wrong that was obvious. And obviously in the resistance, we wouldn't have anything to do with deferments. I mean, deferments, draft cards, you name it, we didn't have anything to do with it. And I think it made an unequal system that was part of why it was the kind of war it was.
Thank you very much for your presentation this evening. I had a question about whether any of you experienced infiltrators from enforcement, from police, FBI, that were able to get into your organizations. And if so, were you able to touch or transform those individuals in any way?
Mm-hmm. Well.
Any undercovers?
I mean, what do we do? I mean, we can transform.
They were certainly all over. But we had a, I mean, our advantage as an organization was that we were open anyway. You know, our approach was totally transparent. So, you know, you can spend as many spies as you want after us. You know, I mean, you know, it's if you don't have anything to hide, then it's pretty hard to spy on you. So we didn't face, we certainly faced infiltrators, but they weren't of great danger to us because, I mean, most of the infiltrators that I had experience with, either through other organizations or later as a reporter, were provocateurs. You know, that was usually if you went to a meeting, the guy who was talking loudest about he was going to take his piece to the demonstration and he wasn't going to put up with any shit from no pig, blah, 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 blah. You know, and come on, join me. You get some gun, get some of this, you know. And so that was a common theme amongst government informants, was that they were used to ramp up people, try and get them into violence.
And you weren't able to transform those
people? No. Once the issue was on the table, they usually weren't around anymore. I mean, they, you know, they got out of there.
We had a guy come into our office, very memorable, who wanted us to, he said, I have a good supply of plastique, and I think we should go out and blow up power towers. And he would just, he was obsessed with this. And everybody just ignored him. I mean, nobody told him to get out. We just always ignored him. He would just keep coming back. Let's blow up stuff.
Another question?
I just wanted to bring something in from the present and in a very positive way because some of this happened just a few days ago. You had five, I believe the number was, people who went out and cut wires into the valves of pipelines. And they did it completely openly. And they called the pipeline company and said, we're going to do this, and we'd appreciate if you turn it off. And what happened is that became super serious when you start messing around with big pipeline companies and wrecking their pipeline even for a day or two. So what happened in this particular case, which augurs well with what you've been talking about, it was completely open. And they were, just like when we burned our draft cards, this guy, they were arrested, and they went to trial. And one of them was just, it wasn't acquitted, but they had a hung jury, which means somebody in that jury decided that what they did was not a crime, but the right thing. So there's non-cooperation, completely openly, risking a whole lot and becoming a success, at least at this stage.
Thank you. Another question right there.
I hear what you're saying about the draft, but what do you feel about the mercenary army that we now have, where there are poor people from the South, poor people being all that they can be, and none of the wealthy people or senators' sons have to go?
I think it's wrong. I think it's totally wrong. The poverty draft. If I could see, how we could do something different, to a variation on what David was saying, that we could, if we think that it's important for people to serve their country in a voluntary fashion, instead of having the poverty draft where people then get some access to supported education
or become citizens of the United States if they're in the military for a certain number of years. People could be doing civilian service and be getting, in exchange, free college education or something like that, but it would be voluntary. So it, instead of the only channel being into the military to fight wars, it could be some sort of civilian service. We have that option. It certainly wouldn't, I'm sure it would be less expensive, but this country wants fodder for their wars, and so we don't do that.
Well, I'm not sure it's directly a war question either. It's let's make opportunities for people.
Exactly.
You know, it's not a question about how the army per se. It's a question about what, how the economic goods are divided up in the country and who's left with the short end of the stick. I think, to me, the most pressing question about the army always, and we shouldn't, you know, it's not just a question of its content. It's how it is used. I mean, that's the issue here. We have just set off a conflagration that is tearing up a good portion of the world because we decided to send our armies in to give the Iraqis a government that we liked. And as long as we are exercising power in that kind of way, then I think that's the first issue about the army that we have to answer. And start using them for something other than American hegemony that allows us to dictate other people's lives to them. That doesn't work. And it, worse than doesn't work, it makes things much worse. So let's talk about how these guys are being used.
Tweet.
So one of you mentioned this betrayal of American democracy, and it seems like something that's happening across the board, but not everyone is aware of it. So I was wondering what recommendations you have to overcome that us versus them mentality that we have now, especially on Facebook, and how we can open that dialogue in the present sense, and how we communicate to other people that aren't aware that that betrayal is going on.
Face to face. You know, it. Electronic communication has its limits. And, you know, I think letting us all eyeball each other and approaching that with an attitude of respect and is the place to start. And being willing to persist at it is also an important virtue to bring to this because, you know, it's not all peace and love. You're just going to be able to walk in and say, I'm here. I really want to talk to you guys. And they're going to say, fuck you. You know, or, you know, there are variations on that. My point is be ready to hang in there. But I think bringing respect, honoring their lives, taking them seriously are all the attitudes that work with people sooner or later. And I think that requires a lot of patience and a lot of goodwill. But that's my recommendation.
One last question.
David, in your initial comments, you made reference to the fact that 50 years later, you are still waiting for some kind of moral accountability for the men that died in the Vietnam War. And I'm just wondering what that would look like, what you would be expecting.
Well, first, it would involve paying attention to that history. I mean, in simple ways, like teaching it. You know, the school systems around the country don't teach the Vietnam War. Most of the Vietnam War classes that exist are out there in private schools. They're not in the public schools. If they get into the public schools, you know, it's usually the last thing in the semester. So, you know, 2 days before the end of school, you get to Vietnam and there it's done. Second, I think our willingness to take responsibility for it and apologize. You know, I think, you know, that the technique is simple. You admit, you apologize, you pledge not to do it anymore. And we do that as a whole people, and we talk to each other about it. And we admit to ourselves that we committed an enormous crime, killing more than 2 million people for no good reason. I mean, that's not a mistake. That's a massacre. And I feel those lives. And I think we need to feel those lives. If we don't pay any attention to the people we kill, we just go on ahead and kill more people. So I think it's that simple thing. You know, we're sorry. Is there a way we can make up for this? And instead, what we do is the same thing all over again. I mean, I see the demographic in this audience. You all felt deja vu as soon as those troops left for Iraq. You said, what? Have we come back around to this? And that's the real way that this has to pay off. I mean, we acknowledge what we did wrong in order to escape keeping doing it again. And when he didn't acknowledge it, which you all remember after the war was over, nobody wanted to talk about that. Nobody wanted to hold anybody responsible. Everybody wanted to forget. And we adopted this notion that it was a mistake, and, you know, which is very convenient. I mean, you know, it can be a mistake to leave the pot roast in the oven too long, you know? I mean, you know, you can say it was a mistake because we didn't blow them all to smithereens. You can say it was a mistake because we did blow them all to smithereens, you know. We have not accepted responsibility. And I think our ability to account for ourselves as moral entities is critical to having civilization.
I think that's a perfect way to end. Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information. 17.